Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. It was my notepad Big Show was reading at Extreme Rules. I think they may as well have held this year's King of the Ring in Rio de Janeiro, and even Carl Jones thought that Booker T's Owen Hart line on Raw was in bad taste.
I'm G. John Chase, and today at work I found out that a girl I like is actually bald. She wears a wig. I don't really know what I'm supposed to do about that. I mean, she's bald, but she's still hot. Well, I guess I can always imagine she's Molly Holly.
Hi, I'm Matt Holt, and I'm returning to the podcast. I work a limited number of dates. I got bought McFlurry by Liam yesterday, which means I get paid more than the rest of them. Somebody get me my due.
I'm Carl Jones, the original voice of Seven, the man who inspired the gobbledygooker, and a person who strongly believes that Aldo Montoya's jockstrap-looking mask is perfect formal head attire.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. And without doubt, my favourite wrestling gimmick of all time has to be G. John Chase's lesbian in a man's body ultra-feminist act. Come on, Chase. No one can like women's wrestling that much.
This is the panel for the 38th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about bad gimmicks in wrestling made good next. Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
My nipples are lactating.
Carl Jones.
I'm drinking tea.
Kieran O'Rourke.
I'm cool as fuck.
And joined for the first time in a while by Matt Holt.
As requested by nobody, I'm back!
Yeah, so here we go. We've got a very packed show today. I've been looking forward to this one for a while since this was brought up by Arrogantly Grateful from the Wrestling Forum, who sent us over for us to discuss. Bad gimmicks made good is the topic of discussion today. As we threw this out to you guys, there's a couple of different ways to look at this. We can either just typically talk about a bad gimmick that the company or the performer himself made great, or a bad gimmick that you personally took some enjoyment in, even if you're, you know, feel like an island unto yourself. Bad gimmick that you saw enjoyment in and why. So a couple of different ways to look at this. We're going to get some interesting discussion out of it, and as always, the amount of replies we got leaves us with a lot of options and a lot of things to discuss. So we'll go now straight away with what was probably the most popular one, and probably the one that comes up the most when bad gimmick made good comes to mind. Loopy Date from TPWW mentioned The Undertaker, the gold standard of turning shit into gold. There is literally nothing about this gimmick that should have worked. No selling, not speaking, supernatural powers, and a manager whose name was Paul Bearer. But Calloway and Moody made that garbage into one of the five greatest careers in the history of the business. Harmonic Generator from the UK Fan Forum also agreed, says The Undertaker on first glance is a mad gimmick. Magic zombie demon cowboy funeral director. And yet, it's probably the most successful gimmick there's ever been. Goes to show you never know what will stick. Ryan Strikes Back from the F4W message board says, firstly, the answer for bad gimmick that worked is The Undertaker. On paper, that's an awful gimmick. It shouldn't have survived 91, and it damn sure shouldn't have made it through Attitude and all the way to 2015. Mean Mark made that work, even with occasional goofiness. And also adding to this, Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum, one of your favourites, Carl, says, at face value, The Undertaker, as it was in its infancy, was pretty daft. Most occupational gimmicks were fairly straightforward. IRS, Duke Drosy, and Doink were, in turn, an accountant, a bin man, and a clown that happened to moonlight as wrestlers. Fine. However, The Undertaker wasn't just an Undertaker, he was actually dead. Based on appearances, he's a reanimated corpse. It doesn't really make sense. Kind of when Kevin Nash was Oz, which was a place, not a person, and billed as being from the Emerald City, the capital of himself. But whatever. The success behind The Undertaker's longevity stemmed from the character's popularity, which I think came from the fact that when you strip away the cartoon character element, you've actually got an unstoppable badass. The Undertaker was essentially another guy brought in to crush a bunch of guys to build up for Hogan, then lose to Hulk like all the others. The Undertaker appealed, for some reason, immediately. As early as WrestleMania 7, you can hear some fans cheering when the Dead Man hammers Jimmy Snuka like the jobber to the stars that he was, and a summertime alliance with the positively demonic Jake Roberts still didn't deter an increasing number of fans from cheering for him. Watch Survivor Series 91 again. The death of Hulkamania isn't as universally mourned as the WWF would have liked. What really helped him in the end was when the time came for him to look at the lights for the Hulkster, it wasn't as clear cut. He wasn't pinned for three because he was leg dropped to bits. His unstoppable aura remained intact, and Hogan looked lucky to beat him. Hulk fucking Hogan! I'm not going to give the booking all the credit for the gimmick being such a roaring success. If the man behind the gimmick hadn't put his all into it, it would have been terrible. But the man threw himself wholeheartedly into it and decided he was going to be the best, undead, unstoppable ass-kicker he could be. He succeeded in making the most unbelievable character they've ever featured believable. And Carl actually has an excuse to mention Mark Calloway by name here. So
that's very good.
Ties us in very nicely here, because The Undertaker's an interesting one. Obviously, it is one of the first ones that comes to mind. There have been periods where I've really not liked this gimmick at all, but I'm kind of keen thoughts around the table on The Undertaker. Fair designation, you think, is the most obvious example?
I would agree, and I would just like to say also in defence of The Undertaker, you know, the judge didn't bring the hammer down on Jimmy Snuka, so I suppose somebody else had to.
Well,
can't argue with any of the points made there. In reference to the Hogan feud, it's quite interesting, because I don't know if anyone's seen Survivor Series 91 recently.
I have.
And the audible cheers you get in the Joe Louis Arena when he pins Hogan.
Even when the music hits at the beginning, the crowd's into him.
Yeah, it's, you know, and you just can't imagine, thinking back now, or even at the time, I should say, you can't imagine a heel getting any cheers against Hogan. Even though it was 91 and obviously Hulkamania's getting a fair bit stale.
A little bit long in the tooth.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it just shows that the character has resonated incredibly well within the space of a year, and it could have been a gimmick that went to hell in the handbasket. You know, like you said, Paul Bearer, you got the sort of the pale face of the manager and the funeral parlour skits. It could have quite conceivably nosedived. So I think it's an excellent choice. What I would say to your point, though, Lee, where you mentioned there's a couple of times where you haven't particularly cared for the character.
Yeah,
I remember for as long a time as I could remember, when it was the biker gimmick, and I thought, wouldn't it be good if he came back as the Dead Man? Wouldn't it be good if he came back as the Dead Man? And then he finally did, and I sat there and I thought, what the fuck was I thinking?
Yeah,
well, you mentioned the reason I want to stress that one is because we make the point there that in 90 and 91 it could have quite easily gone off the cliff, and it didn't. By the time you get to 2004, and you're thinking, yeah, at this point it is hokey, and the bloom is all but definitely off the rose.
I don't know how to really read those early years for Taker, because I never gave a shit about him.
I didn't get into it that much either.
I kind of, it was one of those characters of which you're hoping like your parents or your mates aren't, you know, that they're on when your mates are watching, because it's just confusing and befuddling, and what the fuck is this guy? He's, you know, he's no selling everything, and he's just hokey. So yeah, it's one of those cringe worthy things you hope people didn't see. For me personally, I think really for Taker, it was 96, maybe a little early when he starts, probably a bit early when he starts becoming a bit more human. He's still, the gimmick's still there.
Foley feud.
Yeah, probably. And the gimmick's, I mean, the gimmick's still there, but he's selling a bit more, and he's showing more human tendencies. And from that point, yeah, you could kind of, for me personally, you know, he was kind of acceptable then, because he wasn't as embarrassing. But yeah, for me, I never really liked Undertaker at all. Never have done. Sorry, Mark.
Hey, there you go. You're stealing Carl's gimmick.
One thing that definitely is interesting talking about this is I find Biker Taker a fascinating period, and we always talk about the great rule in booking guys being just let them be an extension of themselves. Is this the one that breaks the rule? Because the biker gimmick is supposedly just Taker finally getting to be Mark Calloway and an extension himself, and generally everyone shits on it from a high, so it's, you know, what went wrong there sort of thing.
We shit on that period the same way in which he shit on the mid-card.
See, this is the thing, I hate this period of The Undertaker as the biker, just because, like, he was so predominantly featured on the show as a heel, especially that 2002 time. God, he was fucking unbearable to me then. It's quite interesting, because after Taker originally got over, I always thought he was a guy that was at the level of the guy he wrestled. If he was stuck with a guy like Gonzalez or Kamala, it was going to suck, and it was going to suck really, really hard. But if he's in there with a guy like a Shawn or a Brett or a Foley or somebody who can drag his game up, the character, the performance, everything was better out of The Undertaker.
I think it's that point when he mid-90s when he becomes established, and the character's kind of like a secondary to the man kind of thing.
Yeah, I actually agree with Keenan on what he said earlier about he didn't connect with Undertaker.
As critical as we sound, we are in the minority, because a lot of people do love this gimmick, and it got over.
That gimmick, though, over the years, wasn't always successful. You know, there were kind of like, you know, peaks and valleys of it. So, you know, you talked about the beginning, which was very good. And then you just described like the bad point, which is that kind of mid-90s. I was like the same as Carl, just saying like, oh, I want him to be the dead man again. And as soon as he comes out, it's just like, this was a mistake.
Look at the guys who's wrestling, though. Again, to that point we mentioned earlier on, Heidenreich. The Dudley. The Concrete Crypt. Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
So what is Undertaker's position in that company, would you say, over the years? Because for me, I mean, if you take him out, how much... Obviously, when the roster's really down, mid-90s, it'll hurt more, but, I mean, has he ever been a draw?
There's been times when he's moved the numbers. The SummerSlam 98 match with Austin was a huge deal.
Good build, yeah. Yeah, it's like the rewriting of history. It's like, to them, he's so important because they can tell us what's important, and he's been there all that time, so he's going to be important. But I just... he's kind of a supplemental character at best for me.
But on that note, though, it ties into the feedback, and it's kind of an interesting thing to throw out there. Ariad mentioned Mark Calaway by name, but when it comes to this character, do you wait more on the guy, or do you wait more on the way the promotion's treated him? Because so few guys have got this level of protection and sustained push over such a long course of time, despite fucking some periods where what he was doing was putrid. I think the guy did a fantastic job in the role, but do you think that's more responsible for the longevity of the character, or the popularity, or the promotional push? How do you weigh it up?
He stuck around, and so I think that's why, you know, he's always been the emotional cornerstone of the company, or whatever. Or he's had a voice within the company. I think it's because he was the guy that stuck around more so than anyone else.
Yeah, I'm always a bit sketchy on that stuck around remark, because you look at it and think, well, what the hell would WCW have done with Mark Calaway? You
know, we saw
what they did with other individuals. You know, the Undertaker name being trademarked by the company. He couldn't go there as the Undertaker. So, I've never been of the opinion that it was as much of, say, a big decision on his part to stay. I always think it was actually quite an easy decision for him to make.
Oh yeah, sure.
And the company do throw out this language such as cornerstone, conscience of the company, all these sort of names to try and emphasise the importance. But to me, he was only ever, say, a number three guy at any point. On the babyface side, he was behind Bret and Shawn. When you get to the Attitude Era, clearly number three behind Austin and McMahon, and then Austin and Rock, and, you know, he's
Austin, Rock and Foley,
Austin, Rock, and obviously Triple H after that as well. He's never been the focal point for any extended period of time. But when you look at the number of title runs that top guys have had within that company, then you look how few he's had in comparison. I think it gives you at least a little bit of an indication of just where to sort of rank him in terms of what the company's pecking order was at the time.
But I think that goes both ways, though, and it kind of speaks to the nature of the character, and that he didn't need the belt to be over. He was treated like a special attraction. He was over regardless of whether he was the top guy or not, so you always had the Undertaker there because the character was over, whereas you could push a Bret or a Shawn or an Austin or a Rock above him to try and draw the big money. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's an interesting point, really, because, like, you know, 98 was a good time for Undertaker, and then he goes back to doing this Ministry of Darkness theme in 99 in the middle of the Attitude Era, and it's just all electricity. It's all really bad. You know, he becomes the American Badass, which isn't the same gimmick, so he actually gets rid of the gimmick before, the successful gimmick, by the way. And
I like the change at first, too. Should say, actually, I did like the change. It felt far more in tune.
He did need the change.
That's what he needed to do for the Attitude Era, yeah. But it's just like, and then he goes back to this kind of dead man gimmick again. So, you know, with what Carl was saying about the fact that he's always, at best, the number three guy in the company, do you think the reason why he was able to keep this character like this for so long was because he was just the number three character?
Taker, in reality, rather than being a testament to a character that sustained, because the character kind of, first of all, it got humanised and then it evolved and it's changed so many times anyway, it's more a testament to the retention of a novelty act.
And to his credit, he always did seem to know when it was time to change and when to kind of, you know, to maximise his own position.
One thing that it definitely really makes me miss when I was thinking of bad gimmicks come good is guys who used to destroy jobbers and then do something after a match.
Yeah.
Like DiBiase putting dollar bills in dudes' mouths. And my abiding memory of early Taker is body bags.
Yeah, the body bags. You know, body bags.
Watching those shows that used to get on Sky where it's just in killing a jobber, you're like, oh my God, just put him in the body bag. And, you know, like things like Jake with the snake. I miss that.
Sid with the stretcher. Yeah, they always put the guys in the stretcher.
Skinner spitting chewing back over everybody, you know, as daft as it sounds. Why does no one do that anymore? No jobbers, I guess.
No jobbers is the answer. Moving along, arrogantly grateful from thewrestlingforum.com says the Mountie. Roddy Piper has said on a few occasions that it reminds him of the Village People. The gimmick wasn't the best gimmick to be given, however, Jacques truly made this work, which I feel is nothing but a credit to him. Jacques is a very good worker that often got overshadowed by the gimmicks he was continuously given. He often had to play the coward too, which didn't help. However, he has to be one of the most entertaining characters ever. He made a bad gimmick work the best that he could and got everything out of it that I doubt many people would have been able to do. He was funny, incredibly witty, fluent, fast on the ball when it came to his promos, created some great vignettes, and he took the character and got his teeth into it. Everyone remembers his SummerSlam moment with the Boss Man in the Jailhouse match, yeah. One of the most entertaining parts of the show, and as a bonus, everybody loved his theme. Jacques was very, very talented and doesn't always get the recognition he deserves, and this nomination was also seconded by Down in 2005 from Pro Wrestling Only, who said, "I love the Mountie. The Big Boss Man feud was good and produced a decent enough match at SummerSlam 91. The Jailhouse skits following are still fondly remembered to this day. After that, he went on to beat Bret Hart to win the Intercontinental title. Granted, his win was tainted and he lost 2 days later, but the title itself was still treated as important at the time, and unlike today, transitional reigns were the exception, not the rule. Just having the title was an achievement in itself, and the Mountie's short reign actually made him stand out. Not content with just having one awesome entrance theme as part of the Fabulous Rougeaus, he went out and got himself another one, and he achieved all this whilst under the threat of litigation from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, meaning he couldn't even use the full Mountie gimmick in Canada. It was cheesy, it was camp, it was controversial, but Rougeau definitely made the best of it." How do you guys feel about the Mountie?
Yeah, this was like, after Undertaker, this was the second one I thought of. Kind of joint with Big Boss Man. I don't know whether you would really want to include him in that.
I would.
I just thought like general law enforcement characters. And so it's just like Big Boss Man, Big Boss Man and the Mountie. Policeman turned wrestler. Exactly, and it was just like that. Obviously, the match when you think about the Mountie, it's going to be that Jailhouse match, which is just like just a testament to how well he does that gimmick with berating the police at the beginning and so on, and just like getting taken to jail, and he's just whining like a pussy, and it's just like a very underrated talent, I think, from Jacques Rougeau, and it's something like turn around in like, you know, that even in a comic book era like that, turn around and said, "Right, you're going to play a Mountie." Right, so you got a dress in all the red with the fucking white brim hat and everything.
The great shock stick.
Yeah, the shock stick and everything. And you got to come out to this music.
Why no horse for a Mountie, though? He never had a horse. Yeah. He's not mounted.
That seems like someone's not really paying
but
attention there.
What he did do was hit jobbers with that shock stick, so he meets my one criteria.
Yeah, but do we blame him for Goldberg doing the J-O-B?
Oh, I see. Oh. All goes back to Jacques Rougeau.
Jacques' fault.
God, would that have been better or worse than Scott Hall tasering him? would the angle work a lot better if Mountie came in on a horse and just shot Goldberg and made him lose?
Maybe that could have been a return to a gimmick for Scott Hall. He could have been like event staff is the law enforcement gimmick. Like stadium staff.
What was the shirt he was wearing? Yeah. So yeah. I don't know about this one in the sense of I never liked the Mountie when I was a kid. I will say in retrospect, he's got a fantastic smug face. He's got very underrated facial expressions. He's kind of got the great gormless look he would get on his face, or the smug smile. Yeah, in retrospect, he holds up a lot better than I thought of him at the time. I really do enjoy watching him back.
The comedic timing he had was fantastic. And he did make a decent fist of the character. But I will say this. I've never liked Jacques Rougeau.
No?
I've never liked Jacques Rougeau. Entertaining entrance music aside, the man used to take a back bump by just blatantly holding his hands out first and then taking elbows as he hit the mat. It was horrific.
It was a very awkward bumper during the Mountie days.
Saddle sore.
to your point, Liam, I hated it as a kid. It is quite funny when you watch it back, though. I love the promos, as brief as they were, with him and Piper at the Rumble and the Saturday night's main event, and the skit with the shockproof vest, if you remember that. That was some great stuff. But the Mountie certainly wasn't one that was on my radar when we were thinking about this, I'll be honest.
It could have been awful. It could have been much worse than it was with somebody else playing it.
I can agree with that. I mean, looking back now, he's got campy qualities that
make really
very
does.
Amusing, but I never gave a shit about him. It was a travesty when he beat Bret in my eyes. No matter what the temperature Bret was carrying, was it 304, whatever it was?
I will say, just to try and put some sort of context on it from where I'm coming from, he did well enough where it's looked back on fondly, whereas if it had gone badly, it could have been, say, another Repo Man from the time.
We'll come to him.
Oh, no one picked him, surely.
We'll get to that, Carl. Moving from one that I can appreciate in retrospect to one that I've never really personally appreciated all that much, Slicky Tricky Damon from TPWW Forum says, Erwin R. Scheister, otherwise known as IRS. A bad gimmick is made good because the guy totally sells that it isn't a bad gimmick. It takes 100% dedication to make a bad gimmick work with an audience. Nothing was ever going to deter Mike Rotundo from making you believe he was an IRS agent trying to get WWE superstars and fans to pay their fair share in taxes. He was a true believer in himself, and that's what it takes to succeed in pro wrestling. I never got it. Every time I ever watched wrestling and IRS was in the ring, somebody, a non-wrestling fan, would always say, why is the referee wrestling? I never got into Erwin.
The most boring wrestler in the world, maybe. Boring gimmick of all time. And turned DiBiase boring in Money Inc. as well. It's a no from me. Sorry. Sorry, Scheister.
He was Rest Hold Randy before Rest Hold Randy in my eyes. So I've got no love for Scheister. And a particular dishonourable mention's got to go to his feud with The Undertaker when he's doing the promos at the Headstones.
But where he's confused about why dead people don't pay taxes.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, not the best gimmick. I think this might be, again, one of those, because they did do a lot of very kind of humorous vignettes with IRS on these Coliseum tapes, where it'd always be kind of, you know, trying to...
Tax tips with IRS.
Yeah, tax tips with IRS. So there's a nostalgic value there when you go back and watch it, how ridiculous it is. But to me, this kind of falls in that category of so shit, it's classic wrestling, you know what I mean?
You know, yeah, he did give it his all and stuff, but it wasn't like 100% great gimmick. I actually thought it actually kind of worked better when he was with DiBiase. Whatever your like opinions are on how good that tag team was, I thought from a character standpoint, I thought that it was a lot better that way. You know, the millionaire with the tax guy in his pocket, I thought was just a kind of a nice kind of dynamic. You know, which would garner heat just to kind of, you know, get heat on IRS and even more heat on Ted DiBiase. Yeah. But in a tag team with DiBiase, I thought it was effective. Yeah,
no hate for him from me. I thought it was fun. My dad was a tax man, so it was a big hit for a 9-year-old me in my house. Shyster was on, so
it could be
my
you,
dad thought he was the business, really did.
Tiger Rick from the UK fan forum says, Umaga was a ludicrous gimmick to attempt in 2006. A Samoan jungle savage. Seriously? It was so backwards it was beyond belief. There's no way it should have been as successful, but it was. The company deserved credit for coming up with a backstory and a handler that, while not credible, were understandable, and they stuck with their plan and slowly got him over with squash matches. They didn't give up, didn't make him a comedy character or whatever. The biggest reason it got over, though, was that his work was great. Hard to believe that he was the clumsy fucker from 3 Minute Warning. He was quick, his stuff was crisp, and his mannerisms brilliant. Even the Samoan Spike should have been a naff finisher, but he got it over big time. And Damien Ray from TPWW also agrees with this one, saying, a non-speaking Samoan savage gimmick, complete with tribal face paint, taped feet, a handler, and a thumb poke for a finish. It had no right being over as it was for as long as it was, but it worked really well. Umaga was always a decent threat and never turned it into a comedic shtick, and was able to get to the point of not needing a manager to cut his promos, but still staying relevant. This is an interesting one, because Umaga went, when Umaga debuted, and for the first few months, especially when he came out with the wild hair that first time, and he was like, this looks horrible. Like, it's what a completely out of date kind of time machine. Kind of the first feeling I got when I watched Rusev more recently, which is like, this seems dated, and I don't know how. But again, it's all in the execution and the push in terms of how well this, and along with the guy as well. The guy did a very good job. But yeah, Umaga, I softened to him over time as became a bit more part of the scenery, kind of became a little bit more human himself, even though he maintained the wild attitude.
Yeah, I do agree with all that, really. I mean, cringeworthy when it came out. He's a fairly talented guy, and he's got, you know, a unique look, and but it's so wacky and kind of very 80s, and just through his own, I don't know, his aggression and his mannerisms, and he was fantastic in the role, and yeah, and he could go as well. Great match with Cena.
There's a match with Jeff Hardy, a great American bash
Jeff
that
Hardy,
I love.
Yeah, fantastic. And I actually agree about the Samoan Spike as well. Stupidest finisher, but it was fairly over. I mean, it wasn't my cup of tea, but it got over, so.
Yeah, no one kicked out.
Yeah.
Kept it strong, protected him all the way.
What I want to know is, why did the referee never call for a disqualification?
On the thumb to the throat?
The thumb to the throat. You know, these officials, they... Right. Much like yourselves, when I first read about this gimmick before he debuted, I was really apprehensive about it. When you think sort of jungle savagery and all that sort of thing, I was just having images of, you know, a Samoan Kamala type thing. That was the mental image I had in my mind.
At first, that's kind of what it was.
And but it did grow on me over time. I disagree with the emailer with the remark of saying he didn't need the manager after that. I think he lost something from the act losing the manager. I'm not the biggest
Armando Alejandro.
I'm not the biggest I'm not the biggest Estrada fan by any means, but I think a gimmick like that does always need a mouthpiece. So I think he lost a little bit there, but a gimmick that I really feared about at the time, but was pleasantly surprised by overall.
I actually think what you mentioned it earlier, I kind of like to do the comparison of Rusev. And I remember like seeing Rusev when he first came in NXT, and actually he was a lot more like Umaga than what we saw on Raw, because you know he had like this gigantic freaking brown diaper on or something like that, and he was just, and he was basically just behaving like Umaga, and I just kind of thought like, this guy's going to get a push, but this guy's just got nothing. And it's just that thing of like, even when he debuted under the Rusev gimmick we have now, I still didn't buy it. It's just like, oh, this is an old gimmick, it's a wrong time period. Exact same feelings I had about Umaga. And then just through the determination and the quality of the talent, and also
Lana
Lana, and with Estrada even more so than Estrada with Umaga, just having key parts in the role, high profile matches and so on, a feud with Cena, you know, it all kind of helped in building both guys up. I'm hoping that Rusev has a longer career than Umaga did at the top, because I think Rusev has a certain quality to him. I think he could be a good guy for quite a while.
With some of these gimmicks, these bad gimmicks, do you think that this is at first, well, like, if you write down on a piece of paper, it looks terrible, but like, and at first you kind of get that gut feeling of this is going to be putrid. But when the guy is good, and when the push is good, and when everything's there, it's like, okay, you get over the fact that it's stupid, and you just look at what is actually consistent quality for a while. They've got such conviction in this wacky gimmick. They do these wacky things, like the enormous Russian flag, or coming out on a tank, and stuff like that. It's just like, they've got such conviction, like, they're going to go all the way with this thing. And if the company goes all the way, and the guy goes all the way, it can't fail past a certain point, surely.
The WrestleMania entrance was glorious, let's say that first and foremost. I absolutely loved that. But I think the key phrase you used there, Liam, was conviction. There are too many gimmicks now, whether they're sort of outlandish ones or not, where the company don't commit. You know, I'm sure you can think of plenty off the top of your head where they get the 2 or 3 a week intro and they quickly sound them.
It's everyone.
Well, yeah, it's almost everyone. But a notable recent example being The Ascension, not that I'm defending The Ascension in any way, but they were buried straight out.
Yeah. Gimmick is born.
Yeah, this week's gimmick, fucking suck. Ascension, fucking suck.
Not that I want to defend the Ascension anyway, but they were pretty much just buried straight out of the gate.
They weren't given a chance. They didn't deserve a chance.
But it speaks to that point of, like you say, when the company are actually committed to it and give it just a little bit of time. Sometimes even the most horrendous gimmicks on paper can at least get some positives out of.
I mean, you just got to look at basically the run of Kozlov.
Oh, Vladimir Kozlov.
Yeah, in comparison, and it's just fucking night and day. Kozlov,
yeah,
just...
but Kozlov had absolutely nothing.
Do you remember when Vladimir Kozlov pinned The Undertaker on SmackDown?
No.
Exactly.
No. The company did look out in the sense of, yes, on paper it's a dated concept, the Cold War is over, but it does coincide with what was going on in Ukraine at the time, so it did have a topical element to it, so I think they got a bit lucky on that front.
Moving on now to one of my favourites, Grappling Apple from Pro Wrestling Only says, I really enjoyed Matt Borner's doink, especially when he was a heel. I thought it was creepy and effective, particularly his escalating pranks on babyfaces. And Vito Cruz from TPWW Forum says doink as well. Wrestling clown should have been nothing more than a joke gimmick. Instead, heel doink wound up being one of the best things ever. Carl, I know that you wanted to discuss doink here.
Yeah, this is the ultimately they would go on to fuck it up, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that.
And Matt Bourne fucked it up for everyone else, including the viewing public, bastard. But it was, when you mentioned this as a topic, this is the first one that came to my mind, and I think it's one of those where the disposition of the character is key. I think it matters in some instances with gimmicks, not necessarily all of them. But some of them, the success can be linked in part to whether they are a babyface or a heel. If they just bought Doink in as the babyface clown doing balloon animals for kids and all that bullshit, I think it would have just crashed and burned immediately. But to have actually this sort of the heel clown, and clowns in my mind have a bit of a creepy vibe anyway. I don't know if that's shared around the table. That might just be one of my phobias. But But I think the idea of a heel clown had a bit of novelty to it, and I think it worked really well. And it was a nice twist as well with the sort of the illusion aspect of it. You know, it's a nice twist on the
it's better than Copperfield.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, at Mania 9, he did only have to outsmart Bill Alfonso, and that doesn't take much. but no, it was the first one that popped into my mind when you mentioned the topic. I loved heel Doink. Not so much a bigger fan of babyface Doink.
Doink gets a bye just for throwing water over Bruce Hart.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is just great. Which is just great. Just like, I always wet myself when I'm watching this Bruce Hart. He has no fucking idea what's happening, and it's just one of those things where you just rewind the tape.
He starts swinging at referees.
Yeah, he goes nuts. It was just I always remember this general feeling going around that people kind of quite like Doink in retrospect, and I never kind of quite got it because I was kind of always just thinking, well, it was a fucking clown at the end of the day. And it's only actually kind of more recently when I actually watched the 93 Raws back, and that entire heel run, as Carl said, and also the initial and just slightly post part of the babyface turn, he was fucking over.
Oh, it was.
He was at least on Raw with that Manhattan crowd.
That's like, what I was going to say.
He was hugely over in that place, and it's just like to the point where it's like it wasn't just the fact of like, oh, should we make the clown babyface? It was just like they had to turn him babyface because he was just getting such a pop from the crowd, and it's just that just stunned me when I was watching 93 Raws back.
A few things you touched on there that I think are really interesting. First of all, that thing of when he first came in and it's the clown wrestler. What you said your gut instinct was, there's a lot of, I know a lot of the wrestlers thought the same thing too, because there's the classic story that Bret Hart told about Davey Boy
yeah.
I don't want to work with no fucking clown. and there was a rumour at one point, I don't know how true this is, because you know wrestlers tell fibs sometimes, but Doink was apparently one of the guys that was pitched to Hogan to wrestle at WrestleMania 9, and Hogan wanted no part of that either. So but the thing is, he was so good in the role. I used to love the whole thing where he would come out chuckling like a jackass and just stop and coldly stare at the camera, and that scared the shit out of me when I was a kid.
The music was fantastic, the music as well, the sinister music.
I think the Manhattan crowd completely fucked this gimmick up, because it was so good in front of this New York wise-ass audience who loves the fact that this guy's fucking around with the baby faces, that they're going to cheer for him just because they enjoy him personally. But they were going to run that building all the time, so it's like, well, we've got to turn him, and then Matt Bourne gets fired, and then they just, like you said, they bring in the baby face, and like you said, Carl, it did go to shit pretty quick.
Well, it's not long before the baby face turn when you get, obviously, you think the Survivor Series, and you got the imposter men on a mission stuff, and the
what about 1 year later?
Oh well, I was going to get to that with the midgets and Jerry Lawler, and at that point it is just complete and utter wrestle crap.
I'm actually kind of not surprised that they turned towards Doink, because like, you know, when you get into that 93 period in particular that I'm thinking about, you know, the product is so kind of like hokey. It'll get worse, obviously, but it's kind of like really hokey, and it's obviously like, I'm not saying obviously the attitude here needed to come in right there, but obviously like certain aspects of the audience wanted to see something different. You know, all these clean baby faces, and then you just get this one heel coming along that's very kind of postmodern, because he isn't just being like the normal clown. He's being this evil clown. And it's just like, it's something that was something kind of actually quite fresh, kind of turning what the initial gimmick is on its head. And so I'm not surprised that someone like a Smart Mark crowd like Manhattan would just suddenly get drawn to something that's completely new and breaking the norm.
It probably doesn't help in terms of keeping him, trying to keep him a heel, that he's fucking around with some of the biggest collection of nobodies you can imagine.
Including, you know, Rob Bartlett.
Yeah, Rob Bartlett. Babyface Bob Backlund. Babyface Kamala. Babyface Crush. You know, when you've got that choice to make, folks, who are you going to go with?
The babyface regime was just absolutely atrocious. I think the only guy
it
watching
fucking
those...
sucked.
the only guy on those Raws that was probably more over as a babyface than Doink was Mr. Perfect, kind of strangely enough.
Yeah, well, he was great.
I think just quickly, the cool thing about the heel Doink as well was, there's actually a lot more he could have done with it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And like, you know, he touched on it when he went to ECW, and he's doing
Born Again.
Yeah, and he's doing like the slightly more real elements to it, not the man behind the paint and stuff. You know, much further.
There's
like
a lot of mileage in it.
He could have like
to.
If he's not, he would actually fit in perfectly in the Attitude Era if he was like the, you know, the more human evil client.
Evolve over time into that. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So that's props to the Born and heel doink.
Yeah, I think it's totally into the form of that one. Vito Cruz also suggested Goldust also comes to mind behind the obvious ones. Dustin Rhodes absolutely owned the gimmick no matter how ridiculous it got. He was boring as hell without the gimmick. I disagree with that. But thanks to the great work he did getting the character over, he's been rehired countless times and is still going strong at 46.
Yeah, I'd definitely chime in with this. I've always liked Goldust as a character, and I think what's interesting about the Goldust gimmick, though, is it seems to actually have changed and evolved so many times. Like, originally it had the whole movie theme to it, which then when he made his comeback in about
2002,
yeah, for the Rumble,
yeah,
they did loads of promos that were again then based around films, and then it went away again. You know, I think the character is just... he's bizarre.
and the old crutch they go to. Yeah.
Yeah.
At first they did the Hollywood thing, and then it becomes the gay thing, and he was just...
you're Staggart Rhodes!
Yeah, a great catcall from a 98 Raw. But yeah, the Vince Russo shoot when he's burning the Goldust gear in the trash can to become the religious Dustin Rhodes. Yeah, and yeah, obviously, but he was just so gung-ho with the gay thing. It's like he was just not going to be denied. And even when he became the artist formerly known as Goldust, he was so shameless. And like, just he just refused to let this thing hold him down.
Well, that's... You mentioned earlier about a bad gimmick can work if the talent involved is committed to it. And he was wholeheartedly committed to it. When you think of... you mentioned there the artist formerly known, stuff which was some real bizarre shit. Yeah. And you got the old razor tattoo on his chest, and he's really playing up the homoeroticism element to it all. And I think that one of the reasons that gimmick worked as well, again in the context of that time, the sort of the I don't think of a real tactful way to say this, but basically the character with gay overtones,
yeah,
still in the mid 90s, still in the cartoon era in many respects, cut through a lot of the other dross.
Yeah, I think my first reaction was pissed off, like that Dustin Reynolds was having a shitty WWE gimmick,
because the great Dustin Rhodes that we kind of liked in WCW.
Yeah, exactly. So that was my first kind of disappointment. Then he was actually doing the gay shit, and he's like, oh, fuck, didn't it turn my stomach? It just rubbed me the wrong way. And you know, like Pat's in the dark alley. But he was so good at it, and I realise now, obviously, my hatred was great heel work by the golden one.
But even so, you know, they had Power Slam so worked up, saying this is the worst gimmick of all time. There was so much of this. Oh, they're ruining his career. You know, this is one of those cases. Like, no, I think this actually was this made the most out of it. I mean, he made it work, or they made it work, but this was the peak.
Yeah, it's a really kind of interesting one with the Goldust gimmick. I mean, like, the more I watch of Dustin in this kind of mid 90s period, both the natural and when he came across as Goldust, the more I admire him as the general work and the effort he puts in.
No, really
there's something about the kind of the Rhodes children that kind of, like, they're given shit, and to different scales of success, they always give it the best they can. I mean, Cody's had his fair share of dodgy ass gimmicks as well.
Oh, yeah.
The thing with the Goldust gimmick, which I kind of always find interesting, is that the part that's kind of, I don't know, probably kind of deemed bad, really, in kind of civilized society, is just the fact that, like, they go, okay, so we're going to do this Hollywood gimmick, right? We're going to have this guy, and it's like, right, we'll dress him up in gold then, right? We'll dress him up in gold, and we'll put makeup on him and stuff, but I don't know. I don't think this is enough. I don't think this is going to rile up the average American. And it's like, so how, what are we going to do? What's the worst thing in humanity? What's the thing that really just grates the average hardworking American? Homos. You know, it's just like, that's it. We'll make him homosexual. That's what we'll do. Everybody hates the homos.
But it was more befuddling by the fact that he was always escorted by Terry Reynolds with those pokey nipples every single fucking time, which was fantastic. What's your beef, Dustin?
Exactly. It's just such a weird thing to, like, just turn around and just depict a homosexual character as being heel. Not because he was heel, and he just so happened to be homosexual, but he was a heel. He was a bad guy because he was homosexual.
Dating back to Gorgeous George, that's the way that's the way that they've been treated in wrestling. Well, that kind of gimmick.
I think for all the memories of Goldust, it was even stranger not being a fan at the time, and you just catch, like, snippets of it. Like, I can remember watching, was it WrestleMania 12 where he gets stripped down?
Oh, by Piper.
By Piper, yeah. And he's got the bra and panties underneath. I can remember my dad just going, "What is this rubbish? When's we're in our shyster back on?" Taxmen don't wear bras.
No, but Rotunda needed one.
VaderBombWrestlingForum.com says, I like very much the model Rick Martel. Many guys out there believe that was the reason Martel's career was buried with that gimmick. Personally, I think he was very enjoyable. He was very funny with the arrogance gadget he started to spray everywhere. Everyone remembers the feud with Jake Roberts from The Brother Love Show and Jake's blindness. Rick Martel was I like Rick Martel a lot. I mean, as a worker, obviously, these weren't his best years. He's not a great natural speaker, Martel, but he had moments where there's just this charm there with Martel. You know, he really went for it.
Loved this character. And I think, like, I came along, I started watching in late 91. I seem to have really lived through that phase where these former great workers with massive histories and bodies of work that I knew nothing about existed with gimmicks. Steamboat was a dragon. he was a model. All these things. Tito Santana, I really thought that dude was a matador. And people were saying he was an IC champ years before and stuff. I was like, what? Matador? And I think that that's the crazy thing with all these guys. And I love that period. I think those gimmicks are absolutely cool. Definitely the model. I mean, I know it's been talked about on the podcast before, not when I've been on, but I don't want to stir at that hornet's nest, but Martel versus Shawn Michaels.
Yeah! No hitting in the face.
No hitting in the face. I love that match. It only works because the dude's a model, so the other guys are heartbreak kids, so money for me.
The great promo to Tonko, I always love at WrestleMania 8 when he talks about how he's probably got some reservations about the match. And he's outside scalping tickets. It's just like, this is fucking brilliant. The fact that he'd be like in the ring with the fucking tennis shorts, the shorts there's just charm here.
I also at that time with that kind of character, sometimes like with heel characters, they're behaving like bad guys, but there's usually the heel thinks he's actually the good guy. He doesn't see what's necessarily wrong with him.
Martel's a douche.
Why are you booing me for? But in the case of Martel, where he actively calls his fragrance arrogance, so he knows that he's a prick.
Yeah.
It's just, that's why like the gimmick was so good, because he knew he was a twat and he didn't care, which made him even more of a twat.
In a similar vein to Jacques Rougeau, he had that great smug smile as well.
It's the extension of the chin. He was just
always rubbed that chin too.
He just looked like a shit. The way he acted, he's like, oh, punch this guy in the face.
Yeah. With that SummerSlam angle, I always remember they do the kind of like just the videos back and so on. They're talking about like the set when he's like trying to chat up Sensational Sherry, and like he just kind of like winks at Sensational Sherry, and then she just kind of like turns back, winks at him, and then just, Martel's just got his glasses on, but he just kind of, if you've seen it, you know what it is. He just does this smug look, puts his shades back on, and walks away, and it's just like, it's just perfect.
Moving on to one that's a little bit more modern here. Minnesota Fats from the F4W message board says, Santino Marella. Some of you may be too young to remember this, but there was an Elimination Chamber pay-per-view where Brian Alvarez thought Santino should have beaten Daniel Bryan for the No Longer Exists world title, and Dave Meltzer described Santino as having super heat that night. This was during the phase where Santino almost won the Royal Rumble, almost won the world title at Elimination Chamber, and people were kind of into it as a novelty underdog thing. I always enjoyed Santino far more as a heel than as a babyface. When he first came in, it just didn't work at all. The fan in the crowd as the Intercontinental Champion, it was a bomb. But when he became like the douchebag, obnoxious heel, just a complete cock, like completely full of himself, didn't realise the whole world looked at him as a complete joke, thought he was ace. he was great.
Unfortunately, he's pretty good and entertaining, and they turned him face, and he's still entertaining and fun, but it's
he became face doink.
That's the analogy. Yeah, that's the one.
This is one that I'm not really feeling, to be honest. I was never a fan. Didn't really work for me, and I think Jim Cornette had the right idea.
Santino falls into another one of those periods where I almost stopped watching, so like it was on the fringe of things. And I just remember just being absolutely enamored with the honkometer. Like it was stuff like that.
the honker, what was it called? The honker perfect mountain meter. And he was trying to break the icy title reign of Honky Tonk Man.
Yeah, and that was the sort of thing that as someone who wasn't watching the current product, but that struck a chord with me from being a fan of old, I watched again. I was like, oh, I need to get this on like 56k dial-up videos on WWE.com at the time. So I liked it. Fun. A lot of these gimmicks that where we're talking about the wacky ones, as long as they stay harmlessly in the mid card, just bolstering up shows to make me not feel like I'm watching 3 hours of the same thing, just with a slightly different physique and slightly different coloured tights. That's what I miss probably more than anything, is just different people up and down the card doing different things.
I know this is kind of, I think that's kind of like why some people kind of like this Axelmania thing at the minute, because it's just like, as goofy and stupid as it is, and as pointless as it is, at least you remember it.
It's like a throwback. Yeah. It's a fun throwback.
Arrogantly grateful from WrestlingForum.com with another one here. Adam Baum. I think people either love or hate this gimmick. Some feel he just looked like some dodgy Marvel character or radioactive man, whereas others just felt he looked badass, and for me it's the latter. I feel that Brian Clark had an incredible look and presence about him, and his execution was great in the ring. He could have been more dominant and done more, and I think the WWE dropped the ball on this one. A lot of potential feuds could have been had with some of the other big guys at least. And Nightro from WrestlingForum.com also agreed. I too felt he looked badass and intimidating as a heel, especially with those yellow contact lenses which used to scare me as a kid. His heel entrance theme was scary too. Sounded like the theme from the Kurt Russell version of The Thing. WWE should have done more with him as a heel. If Undertaker wasn't injured and was available at Mania 10, Adam Bomb would have made a good opponent for him at the pay-per-view, in my opinion. It's a shame Earthquake squashed him in 30 seconds instead. Even as a babyface, Brian Clark made Adam Bomb work, and he could have been somebody if the WWE had given him a chance. He was starting to develop a personality and become marketable. He connected with the crowd with the rubber nuclear missiles that he would throw into the audience before and after his matches, and he called his fan base the Bomb Squad. I loved Adam Bomb, and I would love to have seen him have an IC title run at some point in Night 4, Hour 95. So there is a bit of an Adam Bomb nostalgia there.
I always really wanted to like Adam Bomb because he had a phenomenal look.
He did, didn't he?
This guy, yeah, hey, why did he not get an undeserved push so I could have hated the guy?
Considering the situation with drugs in wrestling at the time, he had one of the more impressive physiques on the roster that was left, so you kind of wonder why he wasn't given more of a chance than he was. It had to have been some kind of attitude problem or something that we're not aware of. There's some kind of backstage thing where they just never really wanted to pull the trigger on him, because, and they gave him that fucking stupid name. Like, this is one of those things where I can't call this a bad gimmick made good. It was just a bad gimmick that never really got out first gear. Yeah, but I can see personal enjoyment, because to me this is one of those ones where there's potential in it, but it never really went anywhere. His name's Adam Bomb.
Yeah, it is remarkable that, to use Kieran's phrase, he didn't even get an undeserved push, because, like you say, given the look at the time, you would think that he's someone who would get sort of the, Air Raid is going to love this, but it's surprising he's not someone who got the Glenn Jacobs treatment. You know? Despite terrible gimmick after terrible gimmick, they keep plugging away and keep him around until they eventually found something, which, you know, in this case, was Kane.
Yeah.
But it's remarkable that that didn't happen for him as well. That being said, I never had any particular love for him at the time. I don't look back on it fondly in retrospect, particularly not the, I'm trying to remember what I called them. I used to call them like the Nerf foam things he threw into the crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have any nostalgia for those in any way.
I preferred Chronic.
Oh, why?
Oh,
Chronic,
yes.
Yeah, I know. That's how much I hated Adam Bomb.
Oh, okay. I understand that. Then I'll accept that.
While we're on Chronic, though, I've got to give a shout out for Crush. Hawaiian Crush. I'm not sure if it was just because at that point in my life I like really had a penchant for bright colours.
I like Crush too, the same reason.
I remember having a brightly coloured bum bag, which I'm not sure if I bought the bum bag because of Adam, because of Crush, or it was like a similarity in my liking of the colours. But I thought he could have slammed Yoko on the Intrepid. I was kind of disappointed at the time that didn't go down. Yeah, I was a Crush fan until he went dark and he changed to a black singlet.
Nah, Shaka Bra.
Bone
Machine from F4W says, I'm fascinated by a subgenre of this kind of thing. Guys who are given a gimmick as some perceived punishment or burial that proceeded to get more over than they were previously. Like when Perry Saturn beat the shit out of that guy on Metal, so they made him a dumb guy who says you're welcome and loves a mop. And then people were into it, and it was fun. Or when R-Truth paused in a match to have a drink of water, so they made him a crazy guy who was obsessed with water. I forget the exact details, but it led to him becoming interesting, and for a while he was this glorious, insane, Terry Funk type heel. There was just some...
Whoa, Nelly.
I'm a big fan of R-Truth from this time. The Terry Funk comparison may be a push too far.
That might just be crossing the line slightly.
Don't boo me, boo yourselves!
the Pigeons promo from Survivor Series was pretty... there was some great stuff in there. He ends up by saying there was just something inherently funny about a guy being given a gimmick that is so totally ridiculous, but they go for it and commit hard. Commitment is the key. I guess that's kind of a running theme here with some of these gimmicks.
There's that crossroads moment where a guy gets given some of these gimmicks we've talked about, and they go, oh, I'm not playing that, you know, and... I guess I don't know if it's the best comparison, but something like the Red Rooster, where you almost look at it and go, what, you know, I'm a real worker, etc. And instead of these guys, like, you know, we talked about the Mountie, just seemingly went, all right, well, if that's my lot, I'll stick it right up your ass. I'll enjoy it, and you'll enjoy it, and people will get over it. And, you know, on the subgenre of subgenres that we're talking about there, there's, you know, littered with history where gimmicks that almost were going to get going. I always thought that Dean Malenko could have rocked that James Bond run, because I thought that seemed quite fun, but then he retired pretty shortly after it all started.
Yeah, I think if I remember the timeline, like, the invasion began, he was kind of lost in the shuffle, so he just fucked off.
Yeah. Lita liked him, I think, though.
Yeah, there's something there. Todd's autographs from WrestlingForum.com says, Disco Inferno. The guy looked like John Travolta from Greece, and he just came off as a dick. The fans would boo him enormously, and he'd be still strutting around like his shit didn't stink. He played the character perfectly. Couldn't think of a better guy for this gimmick, comedy gold. And Ryan Strikes Back from F4W also said, as for a bad gimmick I enjoyed when I was in middle school, I really was rooting for Disco Inferno. I have no idea why, but I found him entertaining as hell. Looking back, even with today's standards, I'm not sure how that gimmick wins the Cruiserweight and TV titles like he did. I liked Disco at first when he first came in as well.
I'm going to say, I preferred his music video to Conan's music video. I'll say that much.
Exactly, that was great.
But no, this...
not so much the Disco Duck. I wasn't a big fan of that period.
No, not particularly. But I think this goes back to one of Holty's points earlier, where so long as it's a gimmick that's kept away from anything overly serious, it works really well. And he is another one that committed to it, and I remember particularly in sort of 96 when he's really going for it and stopping mid-match to fluff up the hair, and you got the disco ball image in the background as he's making his entrance. It worked really well so long as it was part of the mid-card.
Yeah.
And then they stuck him with the NWO red and black.
Yeah.
Even if it was just as a lack, and you sort of thought, no, you're going a bit too far with this now. You just want to put the brakes on and just nudge him back down that card ever so slightly.
Moving on to another musically inclined superstar here. Demo Time 2 from WrestlingForum.com says, country music star Jeff Jarrett. I think this is a great example of a company getting completely behind a gimmick more so than the wrestler. Even though this might sound silly for a wrestling gimmick, what got it over in terms of credibility is they actually gave the character layers. From the very beginning, they told you who he was, what he wants, why he's there, and what he's trying to achieve. He was a guy using the WWF to catapult his country music career through the popularity of wrestling. He was going to get a recording contract. Makes sense, sort of. He was going to
Mickey James did.
He was going to prove to the world that he was the world's greatest wrestler, world's greatest singer, and the world's greatest entertainer by any means necessary. I think I've heard stories where Jeff didn't really like the gimmick, but the WWF definitely did. They had dozens of vignettes for him. They even had the guy do a concert in your house and gave him the roadie. He was just a really well-rounded character. Plus, you add Jeff's great wrestling ability and his mic skills, and you've got yourself a winner. I'll use this time to mention about how much I loved Jeff Jarrett when I was a kid. And how the strut. I love the act with the roadie. I thought that was a great combination.
Yeah, they were really fun together, worked really well together. Without the gimmick, you wouldn't have been anything in that company, but at that time, he absolutely needed something, I suppose. Wasn't necessarily a fan myself, but then he was a heel, so I think that was part of the ploy. Plus, he was fighting Shawn in your house too, so I was never going to like Jarrett.
Yeah, never gonna like Double J after that.
It was absolutely fine for its time. I think to the emailer's point, that it was clearly something the company really loved, to the extent that they, even when they bought him back in 97, it wasn't long before they tried to revert to type and go back to country music star Double.
After he'd done all those promos saying how it killed his career.
Yeah, and within what, four months, something like that.
Yeah,
no more than that. He's then become the country music star again. And as if history wasn't repeating itself enough, he also does another concert at and in your house, this time with Sawyer Brown. And bonus points for anyone who can remember the name of the song.
I have no idea.
I believe it was I Ain't First Class, But I Ain't White Trash.
Carl, you're getting McFlurry for this. That's amazing. Yes. That's amazing. Yeah, it's when they're reading observers from this period of time lately. Meltzer says that Jeff Jarrett is the least overpushed wrestler on the roster until the roadie comes along, in which case things turn around a little bit for him. Gok from Pro Wrestling Only says, I'm a mark for the Boogeyman, and I'm not ashamed to say it. The guy went all in on being the Boogeyman, and that's what made it endearing to me. The Boogeyman ate worms. Real worms. Live worms. A lot of them. A lot of different times. That is a man who is dedicated to the craft of professional wrestling, and I don't care what else you have to say about him.
I'm going to have to say something about this commitment theory that's going around. Hitler was committed, and look where that got the world. Boogeyman fucking sucked.
I completely share Kieran's sentiments there. When we talk about you're talking about bringing Undertaker back as the dead man and not fitting the time, in that instance really coming across as hokey, the Boogeyman absolutely fits that to a T. Far too hokey in my mind for the modern era.
It's just from what that guy's saying, he's saying that Boogeyman deserved props just for the fact he was willing to eat worms.
Yeah,
that was just it. That's just like some jackass shit. That's like the equivalent of saying, like, if Steve-O went into the ring and stapled his nuts to the ring apron, he deserves to be world champion.
It's like, I don't think he's saying he deserves to be the world champion. He's saying he appreciated the gimmick.
I've got no major beef with a gimmick like Boogeyman, because I think gimmicks like that give guys a career after that and allow them to work the indies, because really, let's face it, no one's going to go and watch the Boogeyman on an independent show just because he's wrestling and, you know, watch him take a two back bumps and a hip toss sort of thing. People want to go because they think, oh, I remember him on TV, and you know, you can argue it out, and I'm sure he'll pop up soon, might even be a segue to take us to him. But the Honky Tonk Man, that, you know, that gimmick has kept him still working because people want to see him and have their photo taken with him. It's not because of the matches he's still working, I'm sure. So also because of the matches he was working back then, right?
I think he actually officially retired late last year.
Ah, they never retire. So, Boogeyman, I understand what his point is in the sense of... because, I mean, it was horrible, let's be honest. And the fact that they had him beating Booker T and JBL on, like, major pay-per-views, that's where it's a bit of an issue.
That's why it's so piss-poor to me. We mentioned before about, you know, these gimmicks are fine if they're sort of kept in the mid-card, kept away from being anything serious. This is a gimmick that was never treated as being anything serious, but yet they put him with the more prominent names in the company and had him beat them.
Booker T was like the world champion a few months later.
He was a terrible, terrible worker.
He was awful. Forget that. When he's doing the little kind of skits backstage where he just appears doing weird things, I didn't mind him then, but it's that forcing him to do too much, you know? You mentioned the Honky Tonk Man there, and that was one that no one mentioned in the feedback, and I was stunned because... an Elvis impersonator who came in as a babyface to the WWF saying he was Hulk Hogan's friend had no business having the kind of run that he ended up having. I don't know if you want to say it's commitment or the fact that they just chose him to be the Intercontinental Champion for so long, but he got a lot out of it and he became a draw.
Well, I always got the vibe that the IC title run came about completely by fluke because of Steamboat wanting time off, and I always got the impression it was Vince just punishing Steamboat. You want time off after we've just given you the IC belt? Okay, I'm going to have you drop it to this guy.
I like Elvis as much as the next person, but I fucking detest Elvis impersonators. the lowest form of cunts over in America. I don't like Elvis impersonators. It's like, get over it. And so in terms of the Honky Tonk gimmick, it worked for me watching it as a kid because I fucking despise the man. And I fucking still do. When I watch him, I fucking hate this guy. And so I continue to watch him because I realise, like, he's doing his job. You know, I'm going to watch him because he's actually being an effective heel, because he's actually drawing a genuine emotion out of me even now at the age of 31.
He's so wacky.
I was going to say, in this age...
he does do it so well, yeah, I must admit.
Coming through the Attitude Era and, you know, we're kind of still living in... there's not many real heels around. There's nothing likeable about a fucking Elvis impersonator.
It's just the whole thing with just like with just the music. I've just been watching, unfortunately, I've been watching 94 WCW. I'm watching that new music video he does when he debuts for like two shows in 94.
Oh yeah,
it's basically like a rip off
of
his WWF one, and it's just fucking horrid. And there was some fun with it, you know, with Jimmy Hart and freaking Craig the Hammer Valentine.
I know, Rhythm and Blues.
He dyed his hair black.
Yeah, yes. Some of those moments when Valentine does facial expressions like Elvis into the camera are just completely ridiculous.
I think, you know, there's something innately British in me that loves a variety performance, and I think that people like Honky and even Rhythm and Blues Greg Valentine, as long as they're in moderation, have a place on a wrestling show for me. And
Crossface Chicken from Pro Wrestling Go. Actually, this one got quite a few votes. Akeem would rank higher if he wasn't so great as the One Man Gang before making the switch. If One Man Gang had sucked, then I could see enjoying Akeem, but whenever I saw Akeem come dancing out, I chuckle but want the One Man Gang back in about 10 seconds. Keith Houchin from the UK Fan for form. Also says Akeem, fucking ludicrous really, but I loved him and Bossman together. His funky strut was perfect viewing when Slick was wearing his red suit. And Something Savage from Pro Wrestling Only says the same thing. Gang took the ball, ran with it, and just fully embraced the gimmick change. And hey, plug Jive talking Slick into the mix, and yeah, it gets over huge in this household. A guilty pleasure in every sense for me, as G. John Chase does the Akeem wrist movement that he did in all his promos.
That's what he did! That was his entire character! It was just that!
It's just hilarious. It's hilarious that this guy, born completely out of the fact of trying to rip on Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, was like one of the top heels in the company, and was just hilarious with how goofy he was. The vignette where they turn him from the one-man gang to Akeem.
With Gene Okerlund in the in the streets around the burning barrel.
Another great theme song too.
Oh, one of the best of the era in my mind. But it fitted the era perfectly, and it wasn't around for that long. It was just sort of around long enough for it to not become completely overbearing and just drag on too long. So I think that's why people can look back on it a bit more fondly.
I was just thoroughly confused with Akeem, to be honest.
Me too. I kind of watched him in bewilderment most of the time.
I just the action figure was cool because he's like fully dressed in his blue garb
and his big hat.
But yeah, no stocking whatsoever. I was just confused by this white guy from Africa.
Exactly. It's like, I always thought of him like, what's the little thing, the little Martian that pops up on the Flintstones. I can't remember his name.
Oh, yeah. Jetsons.
Kazoo or something like that. Yeah, it's just like, this guy just seems, like, even for the wacky cartoon WWF, it's like, a white African guy? Like, wait, like he's from South Africa? I don't understand.
But the thing that kind of got me with that was just like, what the fuck was his connection to Big Boss Man? Yeah. For so long? Like, two completely different characters. What was their connection? Other than the fact they were both fat? You know,
well, I don't recall it ever being explained, if I'm honest. I think something that probably helped me with Akeem as well was the fact that when I first saw him, I had no prior knowledge of the One Man Gang. So it's not as if I could sit there at the time and say, oh, what the fuck are they doing this for? Why can't he just be One Man Gang? So I think it sort of helped keep away any sort of negativity on my part.
Yeah, becoming a fan in the early 90s is one of those things where I saw him first as Akeem, and then when I saw the One Man Gang wrestle, I immediately identified him by those grunts. It's just like, that's Akeem. I know that's Akeem. You're not putting this one past me, Vince. Something Savage in Pro Wrestling only had a few good ones here. Three count. I think Jimmy Hart was onto something with that idea. This group had the typical heel traits and attributes that you'd expect, combined with the added goodness of tapping into a timely trend. Boy bands were doing gangbusters then, and this actually gave WCW the chance to grab hold of some semblance of pop culture. They fumbled it, but it had its moments.
What were those moments?
Can't
get you out of
my... I gotta admit... I did like three count. I was just like, in the closing days of WCW, there was a lot of shit on that show. But the only things I really kind of kept watching was the feud between three count and the Young Dragons, which I thought, because there was a lot of good talent in there. And then when obviously they had Jamie Noble and Courageous split, and it became three tag teams and so on. It was all good. And yeah, that gimmick is one of those ones where like on paper it's such easy heat, because you just know that any sensible guy is just going to shit on those three people.
Fucking,
you know,
boy band wrestlers.
Boy band wrestlers. It's particularly the way Evan Courageous just looked as well. He's also a fucking pretty boy. It's just like that fucking bell end, you know. It's just the fucking the Dayglow lime green trousers that they wore.
And the green circles.
Yeah, the dots they have to stand.
It's really,
yeah. And then it fucking made it worse by having fucking Tank Abbott as like, was that their roadie or something?
Now I disagree at that point, because that is the one point at which I actually found them slightly entertaining. When Tank Abbott's there as their biggest fan lip syncing along.
Was it something like with the nipple part cut out of his t-shirt?
Yeah, that was it.
He also says Rico, particularly after he became the Adrian Street clone. Maybe I'm just a huge mark for the character, but I thought Rico played and looked perfect for that role. His interactions with Charlie Haas, Jackie Gator and Dawn Marie turned out to be more entertaining than they had any real reason to be.
I have to put my hand up and be a closet Rico fan. That might have been a dangerous choice of words. One that's almost got a personal backing to me, because I was at uni when around that period, and I started watching wrestling with people that I lived with who weren't wrestling fans, and they absolutely loved Rico, Billy and Chuck and Eugene. And that shit, honestly, I was trying to sit there and be like, you know, oh, this fucking Eddie Guerrero JBL match, fuckers be bleeding all over the place. And this one, they were not interested. They, you know, they loved larger than life, stupid, wacky gimmicks that they could all laugh at. And that was monster over. And Rico, yeah, you know, I again, mid card, keep it where it belongs, and I enjoyed it. I actually thought he probably had a shorter run than he could have had, really.
He was better when he was with Billy and Chuck. That I think is more of a kind of choice rather to say with old the one Billy Gunn.
Let's move to that now. Claude Four from Wrestling Forum says Chuck, Billy, and Rico 99.9% gay, bleach blonde hair, matching Valentine red attire, headbands with names on, and a hairdresser with pork chop sideburns. On paper, this bombed, but they really made it work. I enjoy this due to the fact that all three guys seemed to really take it on board and held nothing back at all, churning out some great TV. You know what? This is one of the few times I'll do this, and that's give credit to Billy Gunn, because for a guy who was in DX, the fact that he was fully willing and able to do that scene backstage where they're stretching their groins, like someone under the bikini contest in the rings, like that the meat. You know what? They went for it, you know?
They did, and the music was a nice little accoutrement to it as well. Really accentuated things really nicely. Good to me. Again, we talk about camp value before, and obviously this was filled with camp value. I think the bikini contest is one that really sticks out in my mind when you mention them. But they both really did go for it. It was enjoyable up until the wedding skit.
First of all, that angle's great. I love the angle.
I wasn't a fan of that.
I thought
that was just it seems strange to say it, but that was almost too on the nose for me, the fake wedding.
You know what though, it's just like they were fucked as soon as they came. It got the big pop, which is like one of those things where it's like, we're not gay, yeah, we can cheer them now, and then that killed them. They were useless after that. It's like that was the appeal. Even though it did lead to the great Eric Bischoff reveal and the beatdown that I thought was fantastic.
I always think that it's, you got to look a little bit more detail at the gimmick to see how it worked. And I think it actually was brilliant that Billy was like this, like, slightly older, like, sort of wrinkly, tanned, old gay guy who was, like, hanging out with this much more buff, young gay guy. And that's why I liked it. You stick two guys of the same age together and it didn't work, but it was like, Billy was like, look how buff my buddy is. You know, like, it was
look
money.
My chuck.
I loved it. You know, like, Billy just worked it brilliantly.
My buddy's called Chuck.
That cracked me up. Going back to something savage and pro wrestling only briefly, he says the super heavyweight Harley cousins when they literally
carry. You still got enough Billy?
I just never thought of that before, and now that you said it, just fits so perfectly. Here we go. So something savage is the super heavyweight Holly cousins, where they literally carry the scales to the ring and demand their opponents weigh in before each bout. Tremendous. And like you said, this did lead to the great line, Carl, off microphone with Gangrel.
You're referring to the, what about you, Kev Chuckley, you fat bastard, why don't you get on the scales?
Yeah, the big shot Bob Holly, you know, I had time for the big shot.
Yeah, I've never been the biggest Bob Holly fan in the world. Big shot Bob Holly was at least entertaining for a few months.
Yeah, that was when I first started watching again. I really enjoyed Bob Holly during that period. And when it started to get tired, in came Crash. That worked for a while. When that started to get tired, they brought in Molly. You know, that to me, that was just sensible, slow, piece-by-piece build, instead of four Cena versus Rusev matches in a row.
CS from Pro Wrestling Only. Carl, you mentioned his name before. The Repo Man. It was cheesy as hell and never rose past low mid-card, but Barry Darso embraced the hell out of it and made it work. Laura from F4W says the Repo Man hated unfairly as an undercard heel. Guy played that fucking role to perfection. He even snuck to the ring during his entrance. Dooley from Pro Wrestling Only says Repo Man got mentioned, but pretty much anything Barry Darso got stuck with. Blacked up bully, Payne Stewart. Darso just committed to the role so much he wound up laughing in spite of, or perhaps because of, the ridiculousness. And one more here. Bad News Gertner from TPWW Forum says, anyone remember Barry Hole-in-One Darso? He'd bring a putting green to the ring and make a jobber attempt to putt, and then nail the jobber with a putter after the dude missed. WCW Saturday Night 2000 gold, my friend. Carl, you don't seem too thrilled about the Repo Man here on this Bad Gimmicks Made Good list.
Yeah, I've got I've got nothing against the person portraying Repo Man, and I will say this: I actually absolutely loved Demolition as a kid.
Oh, me too. I was all about the demos.
I know that there was a notion of them being a Road Warriors knockoff, but I didn't really think about that at the time. I just thought they were a really fun tag team. But the Repo Man, yet not one I was ever a big fan of. I do appreciate the way he used to sneak to the ring, particularly at we've mentioned Royal Rumble 92 a few times before. I don't think we've ever mentioned that one, the way he sneaks in then and gets thrown out by the Boss Man and still then sneaks to the back. I give him credit for that, and that was commitment to the cause. But by and large, now the Repo Man was never one that I was a particular big fan of.
You know who also didn't seem like the Reaper Man was Gorilla Monsoon? Is that just me? Grip Monsoon always seems to bury the Reaper Man on commentary. The Invisible Boy from UK Fan Forum, with a more recent one, maybe a bigger candidate. I think the next obvious one after The Undertaker must be Kane. The whole story of those two is such a big gimmick, I wouldn't necessarily say it was bad, more far-fetched. Saying that, however, the evolution of Kane has been a rocky one, I'll say. The debut of him as Taker's brother and the whole backstory of the death of the parents and so on was amazing. His first appearance ripping the door off the was incredible, and for someone to look even more like a monster than Undertaker was unbelievable. As time went on to more recent years, many feel they ruined Kane. Having him show up at Christmas parties with ribbons stuck to his mask, it made him look ridiculous. The loss of the mask destroyed the backstory of him being all disfigured and burned. The way they tried to explain it was that he was mentally disfigured. The loss of the mask destroyed the mystery of Kane and what monster lurked underneath. In terms of a bad gimmick made good, and this is one of the to me, if there was ever a podcast when we were going to give Kane some credit, I think this would be the one, in the sense of when this was first announced on TV, when Paul Bearer did the promo saying your parents, that you died in the fire and you got a brother you thought was dead 20 years ago, he's coming to the WWF. I thought this was just going to be like the shittest thing in the world. And then the debut at Hell in a Cell was so well done, and the first 6 months of booking was so well done, that it made him like, well, he's still around. Partly to do with the push, obviously, because he was smashed over everybody, but he played the role well.
Is he a bad gimmick turn good, or a good gimmick turn bad?
I think it's a bad gimmick turn good that then turned worse.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, he's still a great position, though, from the start, but you know, it's Undertaker's brother, so it was in a massively...
Hard to fail.
Yeah, massively high-profile position, so it was a good spot if there was anything there to get traction, and the early gimmick definitely got traction, and it's kept him in a job ever since.
Just to backtrack slightly to what I said about Akeem and the way he was around for maybe just about the right length of time. Yeah. Kane's the other end of this spectrum. But as much as I mock and bitch and moan about Kane, the first 6 months were done really well, and the debut was fantastic. And as we referenced before, Glenn Jacobs had plenty of shocking gimmicks beforehand, and this really was, I think Foley mentioned it in his book, and I think others have alluded to it as well, it was pretty much make or break for the guy.
Yeah, Cornette said it too, I think, if I remember right.
So, you know, the fact that he'd had such terrible gimmicks before, this could quite easily have panned out the same way.
One of the reasons I think that Kane's got kept around as well is because I think they know, no matter how much, like, 10 months of dross they put the character through, they know there are always a few squash matches and a mask away from him just being hot again for 2 months. You know, people will definitely jump back on the bandwagon for a month or two of nostalgia, then it's done again. You know, it literally is like the Hogan return, you know. As long as you keep that thing, that's why, as much as we say, oh, it's a pain in the ass that Brock can't work more dates. No, that's exactly why we like Brock, is because he doesn't work many dates. We don't get bored and we don't get overexposed. And I think that's the thing is, you know, Kane's one of those guys, he will literally be around, I think, till he retires and then probably move into some sort of other role with the company.
But why can't he move into another role now?
Take early retirement. So many other people aspire to it.
Fantastic from Pro Wrestling Only with One That Matter, you mentioned earlier on. Eugene was pretty atrocious until people realised that Nick Dinsmore could A, actually wrestle, and B, was very committed to getting the gimmick to work. Sure, it was well past its expiry date in 2006, but the whole classic underdog stuff and the nostalgia throwbacks with Eugene imitating pro wrestling moves of the past greats was awesome.
Do you think Dinsmore is more pissed off by the fact that probably people thought he actually did have Down syndrome?
Do you think it's a matter of like, kind of like,
well, I did.
You thought it was a shoot?
No, but yeah, it's not exactly the most tasteful when it first came out, but he himself did a fantastic job in it, but it's very cringeworthy at times.
It's really bad.
Just the guy, yeah.
He mentioned 2006, and I'll remember this till the day I die. There was a segment on Raw where the con man, Rob Conway, was talking to backstage with, like, doing an interview. And then Eugene came up, beat him up on the floor, and then looked at the camera, and then did, like, the most ridiculous retard dance I've ever seen, completely sticking his tongue out through his bottom lip. And it's just like, if someone's watching this and has never seen it before, what are they going to think about Eugene, you know? Classic example, though, of a guy that, okay, looked horrible, it got over a bit, and then massively overexposed and killed it dead.
Yeah, and didn't they even try a Eugene heel turn at one point?
Yeah, boo the angry retard. Yeah.
Boo the angry retard.
Was he, like, getting too many benefits or something?
No, I think it's like he was trying to attack Maria or something, wasn't he? If I remember right,
it's something ridiculous like that. But yeah, it's one of those that got over far beyond anything that it should. I mean, you know. Worked a pay-per-view with Triple H,
yeah,
for God's sake. And we know that old Trips isn't doing anything like that unless the character at the time is over.
Yeah.
So I think it's
classic Triple H gravy training, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. But it speaks volumes of how well the gimmick got over initially, that wound up being a program. But as you say, horrendously overexposed.
Did lead to the great Regal promo on Raw, do you remember that?
No, I'm not. Which
oh,
one was
it's
that?
Great. It's when Triple H, because they did the whole thing where Triple H was Eugene's favourite wrestler. And then when, yeah, Triple H kind of befriends him and then turns on him and Regal's crying.
The whole Benoit thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Regal's, like, crying over the fact that his friend Eugene got beaten up and backstabbed. And then he comes out and cuts this awesome promo on Raw about how Triple H is just a bastard and he's going to beat the fuck out of him. It's great.
Oh, God, I'm going to have to look that up now.
Look it up. It's worth watching.
I will say as well, it is only my second favourite disabled gimmick behind Zach Gowan.
You want to talk distasteful on that front with a gimmick, though. Anyone remember the skit with Sable in the back and Zach Gowan?
No, what was that?
It's on a SmackDown. He goes to Stephanie's office, and he knocks on the door, and Sable answers. And he says, no, it's okay, I'll wait outside. To which we get the skit up, are you afraid to be alone with a real woman? Next thing you know, they go to a match, it cuts to the back, she's coming on to him, it goes to a break, comes back again, the next thing you know, he's got his back on the table, she's straddling him, and then comes out with a line of, you really think you were going to get with this, you're not even a real man, you're just an amputee, at which point Vince bursts through the fucking door.
And
it was all just a ruse to take the piss out of the guy with one leg.
Right.
I guess that's why Lesnar beat the shit out of him as well. I got to
yeah.
play for his woman.
Yeah. Makes sense. That was great.
That was vicious.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, the F5 beautiful. Ran the ring post.
Oh, yeah.
He pushed him down the stairs on the wheelchair.
Oh, God.
Oh, I love it. Bia Schwale from Pro Wrestling Only. I'm going to go with Right to Censor. It was a very effective repurposing of The Godfather and Val Venus, and it was Ivory and Stevie's Moments in the Sun, perfect silly mid-card heel gimmick for the Attitude Era, and Russo's inability to pull off his own version, despite multiple attempts, and I don't think Heyman did a great job with the network either, is the icing on the cake.
Yeah, I think for me, this is one of my favourite gimmicks, which is that one where you take a load of guys who are otherwise girl as well with Ivory, directionless, and put them together with a purpose. You know, I don't mind stables like that. I think there's almost this feeling of, oh, you put five people together, they need to be ruling the top of the card. Not at all. You know, perfectly enjoyable, got heat. Oh, fuck, the music was heat enough, like just that siren. Oh, yeah, yeah, I thought, you know, it was really a perfect example of it.
Do you think it's a bad gimmick, though?
Because
that's the thing, bad gimmick made good. I thought this was actually pretty smart, like they said.
Yeah, I don't know whether, like, the reason I thought the bad gimmick thing came was, wasn't it, like, some petty angry Vince argument against,
PTC.
Yeah, the PTC. And I think that's where the, you know, any gimmick that's born out of Vince being angry at someone so he takes it out on his wrestling show.
Yeah.
I think it, for me, it made good by the fact that it stayed and, you know, grew a bit, that they get put more people into it and stuff like that. It worked.
Stevie was great, too.
Yeah.
With his white socks. I love the Right to Censor because they made me hate them at the time period, because it was just like, and that's, you know, what a great heel act is. I hated every time they came out, and that was the whole point of the gimmick. You mentioned whether it was a bad one. I don't think it was at all. I think it was a really ingenious idea that worked really well, because it's just, it's during the Attitude Era where everybody's just being dined on freaking bra and panties matches, TLC matches,
sex, drugs, and rock and roll,
swear words and everything, and then you're going to get these assholes come out and basically just say you're wrong. It's the most obvious heat to get during that time period, during the Attitude Era. This is the most obvious gimmick to do.
Multifunctional too, in the sense that, if I'm not mistaken, this is when the whole deal with the sponsors was happening. They were actually trying to tone down the product a little bit anyway. Yeah. So this was a completely functional way to kind of tone down elements like The Godfather, like Val Venus. You know, Mr. Ass had to change his name to the One Billy Gunn because they didn't like that name. Things like that. And again, it's like, what else are you going to do with The Godfather, Bull Buchanan, and fucking Val Venus in the year 2000?
Well, that's it, and they're all in the case of Godfather and Val Venus, they were acts that had reached their natural shelf life in their first incarnations. You know, there's only so many times a Godfather can come out with the hose. There's only so many fake innuendos and porn trailers you can do with Val Venus. You know, those acts reached their natural shelf life, so it was a perfect way to merge them into the new group. It worked brilliantly, and it was, again, another one of those I think was around for just about the right amount of time.
Yeah.
Again, it's a good gimmick. Good gimmick for the time, good gimmick for the guys, natural fit. Proper heat at the time as well, as you said, Chase. I didn't want to see them on the TV, but they were good heels. I mean, if they had a better worker in that crew, could they have gone, any of them gone further? Or would that have been overpushed?
Possibly. But again, given the landscape at the time, which was littered with good workers, I'm not sure if that would have really stood out on its own that much.
The only thing,
consider the fate of Dean Malenko, like we said.
Yeah, they could have done with one kind of really like outstanding worker amongst them, rather than, you know, Bull Buchanan.
And if it was just a case where they'd kept him as the lone individual, I'm not sure how much heat that ultimately gets, because in that sense it's just the ravings of a malcontent.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get members on board, even though it's only a mid-card gimmick, it's still strength in numbers. It still adds some sort of credence to it in my eyes.
LP from Pro Wrestling Only says, here's one for you that I enjoyed since day one. The new Blackjacks. There's the Barry Windham mark in me speaking, and I also enjoy Bradshaw when he's a pissed off cowboy. They looked sloppy and fat as far as Windham goes, but they kicked ass. I wish they would have been pushed to tag team champ status and work feuds with Furnas Lafon and Owen Davey. The tag team scene in 97 was so odd and fun in a way, with the Headbangers push and the Godwins makeover as evil rednecks, mixed in with the All Japan Gaijin veterans and the washed up LOD. Bit of a strange one, this, in the sense of, because the thing was, when I first saw the new Blackjacks, I thought this could be something. I don't hate this pairing. The use of the word new kind of dooms them, and since they didn't really go on to do anything, I don't really know how far you can. Yeah, similar to new rockers.
New is always death in wrestling when it comes before the rest of the title. But by odd, is, in terms of the tag division, is that a euphemism for shit? Because when I think of that, when I think of that tag division in 97, I don't think odd, I just think terrible.
Yeah.
I don't feel any love for the new Blackjacks whatsoever. I'm not intrigued by what they could have been, and I'm not sorry that they didn't make more of them.
What can we say about the new Jack Black? The new Black. The new Jack Blacks. The new Jack Blacks. That'd be like Jack Black impersonators. Two of them. Yeah, there you go. That's about as much that I'm going to give the Blackjacks.
How about the fact they have BJ on their tights? Yeah, Baby from Wrestling Forum says, one of the first I thought of was King Booker. I'm a big Booker T fan, and I thought he did so well with the King gimmick, which was played out to say the least. It could have easily killed his career, but he made it work. The way he started acting so regal and adopting the pseudo-English accent was inspired. The icing on the cake with the accent was the way he intentionally slipped back into his American ghetto accent whenever he was actually angry.
Oh man, all hail King Booker.
I hate it when JBL or Charmel or whoever it was would just fucking keep saying that over and over again on commentary.
I think there's definitely whether the people liked King Booker or not, I think when it comes to Booker T and that gimmick, I think you're looking almost at the same level of Dustin with the Gold Dust gimmick, with the determination to get it over. It's just like Booker T, he was just determined to make this as good as it can, and like everything they described, like the whole presentation, like he changes his music, the little details of like when he gets angry he loses this fake English accent he's got, and goes all ghetto.
Hell no, I mustn't take a dog.
Yeah. It's just like it was entertaining. Did the title reign go a little too long? Maybe a little bit, but it was just like, for the time period, for what it was, I thought it was entertaining, Booker. Was it my favourite version of Booker T? No. But I certainly thought that he was given something that didn't really mean anything anymore, and he made the most of it. So I thought, you know, all fair to Booker T.
I think that's a key point, though, is with a guy like Booker, although he made it really entertaining, it's a gimmick that shouldn't be a serious gimmick, and Booker could be a serious player. And it kind of leads me on to thinking about, I'm not sure with how you classify it, but Kurt Angle's three eyes. For me, you know, no one would probably say it's a bad gimmick because Kurt was so fantastic at doing it, but it just highlighted a bit of goofiness, which, although it showcased Kurt's personality and got him over to a degree, it always hurt him.
Yeah, down the road. Kind of the fact they had him as a geek stopped him from being a tippy top guy for a while until they kind of eliminated that element of his character.
Yeah, but even when they eliminated and made him a serious badass,
they had the milk shit that they were doing all the time.
His character was so closely linked to his personality. When he was cutting a serious promo, you still feel wacky Kurt underneath there. Yeah. So he was always done from that point in terms of a money draw. Funny doesn't equal money, as they say. Going back to Booker, although the King gimmick was entertaining, I don't think it's something for a guy with his potential. It's going to maximise him going down the road, I don't think.
I agree with that, because I remember at the time too, because he won it at Judgment Day, if I'm not mistaken. It was him and Lashley in the final. And I remember for the 2 or 3 months before that, the combo of Booker and Charmel together as heels hilarious on SmackDown. They were the highlight of the show by far. They were so funny, and it's like, they're great together, and they could be the top heel act. And then they slap the King gimmick, and immediately, as much as I love the segment on SmackDown where he knights William Regal, and he does that face where he's just been touched by God when the sword comes across his shoulders. Regal's just awesome. Yeah, it made it goofy and wacky, you know.
And it's just to latch onto Kieran's point of it as well, when you mentioned about damaging him as a draw, funny not equal money. It's the serious stuff in wrestling that draws, and when you put the belt into that comedy mixture as well, I don't think that does it any favors. I really wasn't. I'm not a fan of the gimmick, and I wasn't happy with the notion of putting, even though it may have only been the SmackDown World Title, putting the World Title in the mix as well. Breaks the golden rule that Holty mentioned earlier and puts it too high up on the card for my liking.
I think you made a good point actually when you mentioned what he was doing before the gimmick change.
Doing this whole angle where Charmel was cheating to make him win, and he was like, he didn't realise it.
But actually, deep down he did.
Yeah, and stuff like that. That whole kind of like storyline for the brief time it ran, I thought it was really good. I remember at first thinking like, well, that was unnecessary, because they already had like something working already, and now they've just gone in a completely different direction. But I think that just kind of adds to the point, like, you know, he was suddenly given a curveball, and he just had to go like as you said before with other people before Holty, just like he just kind of went, well, okay, this is what I'm doing now, let's go for it,
I'm going to be from England.
Yeah.
But in terms of moving the needle, would it not be safe to say that his ability to really be a significant draw had already been damaged by the Triple H stuff earlier, and whatever he could have been had already been pissed away.
Moving along here, a couple more. Crazy Edgar from TPWW Forum says, positively Paige, this gimmick was a good thing. Mad Dog from Pro Wrestling Only says, motivational speaker DDP, this was an obvious attempt to bury him, but he embraced the gimmick and had some really funny segments with it. This is the thing with DDP, because I can understand the bad gimmick made good, but it was such a step down from his actual rest of his career that I can't really say, like, you know what? God damn it, he aced that, didn't he? He made it all the way to the European title.
Yeah, he's not. It's not one of those where you can look at the guy and say, well, Jesus, thank God for that, because what would his career have been without it? He already had a fairly storied career before that. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea because of the, you know, scripted matches, point-by-point sort of thing, but no one can deny that there was a time in WCW where he was over like gangbusters.
Sure.
So to go from that to the motivational speaker, and yeah, he gave it the old college try, and he was able to sort of immerse himself in it because, you know, lo and behold, he is a motivational speaker as well, and you play naturally into part of his real life. So it was an easy sort of segue for him. But yeah, when I think of bad gimmicks made good, I think of a guy who would have been struggling or floundering beforehand and was given a terrible gimmick and was able to make a career out of it. And I can't say that in the case of DDP.
Absolutely. I mean, as a DDP fan, like when I was watching WCW, him and Sting were like my main two guys that I'd watch for, and he was one of the few, along with Three Count and Young Dragons, that I continued to watch this WCW shite into 2000. Everything from him entering into the WWF, I've just absolutely hated it. And like it, you know, DDP did give his best because obviously it's paid, for Christ's sake, you know, and he always tries his best with everything. He should never have been in that position in the first place. He was a lot better than that.
He was entertaining in the role. He did his, you know, the old college tries. You know, it was entertaining, but when making the best of a gimmick is significantly lower on the ladder than anything his original gimmick, it's hard to say he made the best of it. So.
And with the final one here, I Don't Shiv from WrestlingForum.com says, Polka Dot Dusty. They gave him that and Sapphire, and he still got it over. This is a good one here. That guy who had such a legacy going to the WWF, and they made him, you know, Polka Dot, the guy fishing the turds out of the toilet bowl. It's like, what a wacky full vignettes.
Delivering the pizza as well.
Yeah. They just completely whacking off the wall. But Dusty was so over when he was in the WWF too.
I think this is a great example of where cream of the crop rise to the top. Undeniable charisma will always shine through shit. And I actually think the DDP thing is, you know, I know that it is a step down from DDP, but I'd say in that gimmick he probably overachieved where the gimmick was aimed at. You watch that Mania 18 match and the crowd pops, but you know, they really
But are they popping DDP for the fact that he's smiling or the fact that it's DDP and they really like him?
That's what I mean. Like, you know, he's sort of still shining through despite the bad gimmick. And I think that, you know, that with Dusty and the polka dot stuff, that, you know, that was it, you know, and really realistically, probably could have been used a lot more than he did there. But it did also give us the immortal Sapphire's disappearance, where a bewildered Dusty is backstage and sees Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and after he sees her, I'm still looking, Dust! And he keeps looking for her all day. I think he's still there in the arena now looking for her. I'm still looking, Dust! Oh!
Because when you've lost someone and you're sending out a search party, the one person you refer to is the cross-eyed fuck.
It's not like Sapphire is the easiest thing to misplace.
Look for the polka dots.
Did he make the best of a gimmick though, or did he just kind of was able to circumvent the gimmick really
and just be Dusty?
It's like he just kind of sidestepped the goofy shit they wanted to do, just continued to be himself and got over because he's just fantastic.
He just so happened to be wearing polka dots. That's the only difference. Same character.
Yeah, it was effectively Dusty with polka dots, and it's credit to his charisma that he was able to overcome it and draw that big house at Mania 6.
I'm still looking, Dust!
Actually, what we're doing impressions, Carl, give me a Survivor Series 89 one-liner of what he was thankful for.
I'm thankful for my polka dot!
Was that Eugene?
I was pulling the Eugene face, wasn't I?
And on that high note, I just want to ask around the table very quickly, any major learns today in terms of bad gimmicks made good or favourite gimmicks, what it takes to make these things work? Is it all about commitment? What do you think?
Looking back in the way we've just sort of had a massive trip down memory lane, it just reminded me how much more fun wrestling used to be.
I think a good gimmick comes into one or two categories, really. It's a completely irrelevant, fun, mid to lower card act, which doesn't get overpushed and it can just be entertainment, or it gets good when a guy kind of almost transcends or evolves the character into a part of himself, and then kind of almost you can forget about the gimmick and it's just kind of colour to the guy kind of thing.
I'd say the difference between you know, a bad gimmick becoming good and a bad gimmick just ending up being bad, I'm not saying this is 100% rule all the time, but I think it's determination. And it's by the individual who's doing the gimmick, and I also think by the company as well. I think, like, if there's enough passion in just like, okay, let's do what we can, then I think the percentage is reasonable for that gimmick to succeed. And it's just, I think that's something that's lacking with today's product. It's just like, with the few exceptions that we've mentioned briefly, with like Rusev and so on, and maybe, you know, others like Mizdow and so on, it's just, everything else is just like, you have like maybe a month to get over with this gimmick, and it's not, then you just end up like a Fandango basically. And it's just like, it's that's the difference between those fun days with all these various gimmicks. They just gave them time to breathe, and they just kind of went, look, everybody just went, I'm going to try and get as much as I can out of this, and the company goes, we're going to be right behind you no matter what, until it really seems like we're flogging a dead horse here. They're just not like that anymore. They're just not patient enough.
Yeah, I think for me, it really comes down to a bit of a Holy Trinity approach or a Triforce approach for me, which is that there's three things. There's is the gimmick good? Does the guy work it, and does the company get behind it? And it touches a bit on what you've just said there, G. And I think in any combination of the three, if you've got two, you're probably not going to do that bad. It's the real gems of the way you get the three of them together, and it really all fires on all cylinders. And it works, and it leaves a lasting impression. And as I say, for me, it is that variety performance mentality. I want to see different things in different matches. Yeah, good fun. And it has been, exactly as Carl said there, a fun trip down memory lane, and just thinking about, man, I do miss things like that, you know, characters and stuff.
Thank you very much for listening this far. If we didn't get to your feedback this time, I apologise. We are not going to be back next week, but the week after that we will be. We'll be returning to our History of the Monday Night War series. It'll be part three, looking at the second half of 1996 in the Monday Night War, with notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters at the time, to timeline the course of events. If you haven't heard the previous ones, you can subscribe to us on iTunes at Squared Circle Gazette Radio and listen to the previous incarnations of our History of the Monday Night War series. I want to thank you guys around the table. For G. John Chase.
What about Max Moon? Yay, nay.
For Matt Holt.
Podcast City, bitch.
For Kieran O'Rourke.
I don't need a gimmick, I'm real.
And for Carl Jones.
I'm going home to work on my dusty promos.
I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.
We're still looking dusty.